Hi, HR Nation. Welcome back to another episode of the HR Leaders Podcast, the show where we explore the future of work with industry experts and HR executives and the world's leading global brands. Today, we have a special guest on the show. We're joined by Claire Schmidt, who's a founder and CEO at All Voices, which is a reporting platform and case management tool that enables employees to safely report harassment, bias, culture issues, and other feedback directly to their company's leadership. Welcome to the show, Claire. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Was that an okay intro to the company? How will I get out of 10? Was that all right?
I've done it better myself.
No, that's like my elevator pitch, or just copy and paste off the LinkedIn profile or website as well. Before we jump in, tell everyone a little bit more about yourself personally and your journey to where we are, because you have a super interesting background and story, like many entrepreneurs, about how you came to be the founder of the organization and you are where you are today.
Yeah, I'm happy to share. So I have had a career that's mostly been focused on kind of the intersection of technology and social good. So I started my career in management consulting, but since then, that's where my focus has been. So I helped Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore start their nonprofit Thorn, which builds technology tools to combat child sexual exploitation. Then I went and ran social impact at Thrive Market, which is an e-commerce company that has kind of a one-for-one model and a mission of making healthy food accessible and affordable to everyone. So my job was like, how do you make healthy food available to people who live in food deserts and to low-income families? So that was really fascinating. And then most recently, I was the vice president of technology and innovation at 20th Century Fox. So throughout, you know, the through line through everything that I've done has been looking at technology, but specifically through the lens of how can this improve the world and how can this make the world a better place?
Mm-hmm. Where's that drive come from?
I think my parents, I was raised in a household where my mom is a teacher and my dad was a lawyer who mostly worked for migrant workers. So trying to make sure that migrant workers had rights and were being paid fairly. So I think I just grew up knowing that it really matters whether you're helping people or not in your career. And I've always wanted to learn, and that's been really important to me, but there's always been this secondary element of learn and, you know, do things that are interesting to you, but do it in a way that is benefiting someone, you know, other than yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I was wondering where that came from, because it's quite, not so unusual, but there's a clear why and sense of why and purpose in everything that you do, even based on our last, we've only spoken twice, but it comes across in both calls and everything that you do as well. Given that then, how did you end up at 21st Century Fox? What was the relationship there? What was that inspired by?
Yeah, so while I was at Thrive, my friend started a new role at Fox that was really looking at how technology could be leveraged across the Fox portfolio.
Which is pretty big.
Yes, which is pretty big to improve the world and to improve the company. And so we had some really, really interesting brainstorming conversations when he started that role about all these different ways in which, you know, Fox's power and kind of footprint could actually also be used for good. So I was really intrigued by that. And you know, I loved my job at Fox. I thought it was super interesting. Those things never became, you know, the number one priority of our group, of our little team. And so that was actually one of the things that was hard for me. And I think that's one of the reasons that my mind started going elsewhere. Like, well, if I'm not doing this at work, then I need to be doing it in my spare time. And that's really the genesis of All Voices, was like the conversations I was having outside of work and the things I was reading outside of work and the meetings I was having outside of work.
Yeah. Now, I thought that would be the case, right, with someone like yourself and even your passions. It must be really hard to keep you engaged, especially in an organization of that scale. If it's not a priority and they're not, you know, you're going to look for it elsewhere, like you said.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there was an intention, right? It was a really good intention.
Yeah.
Like, we'll do things at some point. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's like, I have to be doing it in the now.
Yeah. Can't be. Yeah. So what was the inspiration behind All Voices? Tell everyone a little bit more. I know I gave a very brief introduction, but what was the inspiration? What was that moment when you was like, this is something I need to pursue?
Yeah, well, I can tell you the inspiration and then I can tell you the moment.
Oh, you got both. Great.
Okay. So while I was at Fox, I read Susan Fowler's blog post about her experience with sexual harassment at Uber. And I read it at like 1 a.m, like super late at night. I read it like 3 times. I was sort of in shock. Not because I hadn't heard similar stories from other people, but just, you know, this incredibly high profile, like fast growing company, and this really egregious case, which is that, you know, her manager sexually harassed her on her first day of work. She had evidence. She took it to HR. She did everything by the book. And it still went so badly for her, right? She was told outright, we're not going to do anything about this. She was retaliated against. So I was just in shock about, I think, how clearly backwards our process is in terms of what we're asking people to do who are experiencing things like sexual harassment at work. We're asking them to kind of like put everything on the line and take a step forward and pour their hearts out about something really sensitive and uncomfortable, and then just cross their fingers and hope for the best. And that's what really stuck with me from reading that is Susan is probably an outlier in that she did all of those things and it did come at great cost to her and eventually to Uber. And I just felt like there had to be a better system. There had to be a better way, or at least an alternative to offer to employees who are in difficult situations at work. And so I was kind of consumed with researching and trying to figure out, like, are there any tools out there? Like, my mind immediately goes to technology, right? So are there tools out there that could make this easier, that could enable more people to speak up? And as I was doing research, I found that in the case of harassment, actually 75% of people who experience harassment in the workplace never report it. And then I started thinking about all the other kind of adjacent issues like micromanaging and bullying and bias and mistreatment and even just like challenging things that happen at work that you don't really know who to talk to or how to affect change toward.
Especially when it's your own leadership, right?
Right, exactly. Like who is safe to talk to? Mm-hmm. And you know, this is not a knock against HR because I think some companies have amazing HR leadership who are super responsive to employees. But what I was thinking about was everyone comes into a job with all the baggage of all their previous jobs. So even if your current company is incredible, what if you came from Uber, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or a company that didn't have that type of commitment to its employees. So it felt to me like there was a real need for a third party to kind of step in and provide some type of software or technology that could help people speak up directly to leadership and to help the company get the information they need to take action. And so that's what I was thinking about and researching and talking to people about basically that whole summer of 2017. And then when I realized I needed to leave my job was basically and do this full time was as I was sort of talking to people and getting their feedback on the idea, it was interesting because I was expecting lawyers, especially, and HR people to say, this is not a good idea. This opens up legal liability. This is risky. You know, with HR, I was thinking they might feel like threatened or worried about their role if they were to roll out something like this. So I basically was getting the opposite feedback. People were saying, this is a great idea. And, you know, there's sort of products out there that don't really meet this need. And it would be worth someone trying to build. And at some point during like, you know, my 20th conversation, I was like, I think I have to just go do this.
Yeah. What are some of the things during your research and conversations that HR gets wrong when it comes to anonymous feedback or just feedback in general?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things I learned during my research was I learned about the existence of whistleblower hotlines. I had, in all my years of working, I had never seen one.
I've never heard of one until this second. until you just said
okay.
that.
Okay, that's telling. So in the United States, every public company needs to have a whistleblower hotline to be Sarbanes-Oxley compliant. And what that means is that they have to provide a place for employees to anonymously speak up about, you know, financial fraud and ethics issues with the purpose of protecting shareholders, right? So the idea is that you can identify fraud and embezzlement and all of these sort of financial misdeeds that could affect the ability of the company to function. What's really interesting, though, is that what we've seen over the past few years is there are a lot of things that can take down companies, right? It's not just financial
fraud. No, not at all.
So there's this broad spectrum of issues that really are not intended to be brought forth to these whistleblower hotlines. They're very clunky. They're dated. There's a lot of legal language. They're not mobile friendly. They kind of feel like, as I started to look at these, I was in shock. They kind of feel like, you know, not to bag on the DMV, but they feel like filling out a DMV form or something, or a police report.
It sounds like it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So they get very little engagement and usage as a result. I think part of it is that it's really overwhelming and intimidating for employees to even think about going through this. And then in many cases, they don't, you know, think they are a whistleblower. So there's a branding problem as well. Like, if they saw something that made them uncomfortable, are they a whistleblower? Is that illegal? Like, there's a lot of confusion. So one of the things I heard from, you know, HR and legal early on is, well, you might come up against whistleblower hotlines when trying to bring your product into these companies, because they might say, well, we already have an anonymous way for employees to speak up. And my question that I asked whenever people would say that is, how many reports are you getting through this per year?
And who knows it exists, let alone reporting it? Like, exactly. Who even knows it? Where is it? Where would you even find the link?
Where is it? What is it? Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times the answer was none or one. And so that's not reflecting all the things that are happening in your workplace that you're not aware of. So that was one pushback that I got. And another was, people who had experience with whistleblower hotlines and actually had used them in the past would say, well, you know, I received an anonymous report through a whistleblower hotline, and I never, you know, I had follow-up questions for that individual and I never heard back from them. So I couldn't pursue the case. And it was just a waste of my, you know, time and energy.
Who's it normally to, by the way? Who's it? Who do these normally direct to? Like, who gets this?
Like, usually someone on the legal, in the legal function.
The legal team, so okay. Like
chief legal officer, GC.
Okay.
And in a lot of cases, they also go to the audit committee of the board. And we actually took that feedback and built that into like a differentiator of our product. So we came up with a really creative way to allow the employee to remain anonymous while engaging after submitting their report. So having a back and forth conversation.
All right, they're still anonymous, but they can talk back and forth about them, the employer knowing it's them.
Exactly. And we made it really easy. Like, these whistleblower hotlines are like, okay, thanks for your report. Here's your callback, you know, number.
That just sounds like the DMV, doesn't it? Yeah. Here's your, yeah, exactly. It sounds terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also so, like a candidate experience, they have no idea where they stand. They have no idea if someone actually received it. They're probably terrified of knowing that it's actually them and speaking up. So much wrong with that old model, because it wasn't designed for these type of conversations, clearly.
No, definitely not. And yeah, they're not even, you know, they're really about illegal issues. And so everything that's in this gray area, in which I think most issues fall into, are kind of overlooked. There's not a venue for people to bring them up. And so they just don't speak up. And then they get disengaged. They leave their jobs. Maybe they post negative things on Glassdoor or social media. And it's a loss for the company and for the company's reputation and, you know, for the company's bottom line.
This episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. Two-thirds of employees have one foot out the door in 2024, and the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
Ultimately.
Well, and they may actually have that person still in their company.
Yes, they could have a very disengaged, unproductive, unsatisfied person in their company.
No, I mean, and the person who was the actual harasser.
Yes, absolutely.
Without even, you know, that person may leave. I'm sure, like we said, the majority of people don't even talk up. And if they may leave, you would have no idea.
Well, and remember that 75% statistic I just shared with you.
Mm-hmm.
That means that, you know, let's say this person harasses four people. Only one of them speaks up. Yeah. And then maybe that person is viewed as an outlier. And it's like, oh, well, they're just a problematic person. Like in Susan Fowler's case, let's just push them out, not realizing that it's actually part of a broader systemic issue with that individual.
Yeah. I think I've certainly been in a position where I've been in companies where I've heard things that have been said from my leadership team. And I'm like, who do I even speak to about that? You know, this is the board members in this company who are saying these things and taking these actions. And then I just stay quiet. It's like, who do you talk to? So what's then the role of HR in all of this? When do they step in? What advice would you give to HR leaders?
So HR is critical to the success of this platform, and to make sure that it's being really responsibly used within the company. So in almost every case, we work with HR. Sometimes we go in through the legal team because we've actually built kind of a replacement to the whistleblower hotline in addition to, you know, all these other issues that people can raise through the platform. But a lot of times we go directly to HR, and basically what HR's responsibility is in many cases, they're the ones who receive these reports in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting individual level reports. They're also seeing data, right? So they're seeing over time, this is the type of report we're getting from this department or from this office. And, you know, it looks like a lot of people in the sales team are reporting bullying happening on Slack. So let's drill down into this data and figure out if we need to change our policies, if we need to have a training, if we need to just have a memo or some kind of communication to that team about what's acceptable and what's not. But HR is really, in most cases, tasked with taking action on a holistic level as well as on an individual level for a lot of these cases. So they're kind of running point. I would say when it's an ethics issue or financial fraud issue, a lot of times that will go to like a general counsel to tackle.
Mm-hmm.
But we have 7 modules on our platform. And I would say 5 or 6 of them are probably being routed to HR for most of our customers.
Like you said, the traditional model doesn't even include most of the issues that we're facing that we talk about.
Absolutely.
As well. Do you find there's any pushback from HR? This is me being a bit negative, but I can imagine there are certain organizations and maybe even HR leaders that kind of don't want to face this. They don't want to kind of look this in the face and you see what I'm saying? That know this exists. Because, you know, then you kind of unleash, then you've got to do something about it, right? as well. They're probably afraid of turning this on in their organization. Is that just me being negative or do you see any of that happening?
No, you know what's interesting? You know, we started this company late 2017. That was just when the Me Too movement started really happening. So all of a sudden, companies were being publicly held accountable for Me Too incidents that maybe had never even been brought to HR or never had been brought to the company's leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But people, individuals from those companies were coming forward and saying, this happened to me at this company. And I think that kind of represented a turning point in our culture, which is that I think before that moment, companies and you know, companies' communication teams or publicity teams could say, we weren't aware of this issue happening. And that would actually be viewed by the public as an acceptable response. And they would sort of get a pass, like, okay, well, you didn't know. How could you do anything about it? And I think what changed at that time is people, the public, the press, whoever, you know, kind of contribute, activists, like all the people who did all the work behind the scenes on the Me Too movement, kind of led the charge in saying, actually, you're responsible for knowing what's happening with your employees.
That's not good enough. Yeah. It's not good enough to say we just didn't know.
Exactly.
You don't get a pass anymore.
Yeah, it doesn't, they don't get a pass. They have to be accountable. And I think HR saw that and said, okay, well then we need to know what's happening because it's really our domain. It's our responsibility. And we need to be able to communicate that to leadership, you know, within, you know, our CEO, our board. So I think that represented a pretty big shift. And we saw the same thing happen last summer around the George Floyd protests and the kind of increase in focus on the anti-racism movement. And a lot of companies were posting, you know, black squares in solidarity on their social media platforms. And then employees were coming forward.
That was the worst thing, wasn't it? Because they were like posting it and employees were like, really? Really? Yep. Like,
yeah. Here's what's actually happening.
Yeah, exactly. Here. Yeah.
That, so went that really was well. Kind of like the Me Too movement for diversity and inclusion, right? It's you need to, if you're going to talk the talk, you need to walk the walk. And what I'm hearing and seeing from HR today is just very different than 3 years ago. I think in part due to those two movements and what it represents about what we are asking of companies today.
Well, that's really good to hear because you've even mentioned some of the companies that earlier in the conversation did turn a blind eye. And these are some of the biggest brands that we know in the world. Mm-hmm. And if they're doing it, you can only imagine how many other companies are doing it out there. I've worked, unfortunately, for companies that have also turned a blind eye. And it kind of made it really, from a psychological safety perspective, a type of culture where you'd be scared to say something. Which is a massive part of the issue, right? So for people listening that do want to kind of get started or that perhaps don't have anything in place, I'm sure many of them do, but what are some best practices for putting an honest feedback programs in place?
Yeah, so I think the number one advice that I would have, whether it's all voices or something else, just make sure that it's truly anonymous, because the whole purpose of this is to build trust with your employees. If you give them a safe channel that they can use to speak up and you tell them it's anonymous and it's somehow not, you're going to break the trust, you know, into, I would say, like, your relationships with your employees will be far worse than they were even before you introduced this. And we've heard some horror stories about, one example of this is, a culture survey. So employees were told this culture survey is completely anonymous. We don't know who you are. We don't know who's responding. The provider of that culture survey actually said to HR when selling it, we'll give you a key basically to figure out which employee said what based on the invitation they got to their
Surely working. That's not
it, right.
That's crazy.
And okay. A woman who worked at this company said, in her exit interview, when she left the company, they said, well, we know, you know, how you feel because you told us X, Y, and Z.
She said it. They said it in her exit interview. Oh, my God. They weren't even trying to pretend they didn't have it. They just straight up said it. Oh, my God. Wow.
So make sure it's anonymous. That's the number one. That's the number one piece of advice that I would give. And make sure you can really stand behind it and you know the ins and outs of how that platform works. And the second thing I would say is if you're going to put in place a feedback program, then it needs to have a full feedback loop. And what I mean by that is if you had like a physical suggestion box, someone dropping a slip of paper in a box with, you know, a question or a recommendation or a concern on it, you have no way to follow up with that person directly at a later date, right? Because they just dropped a piece of paper in the box. So companies like ours, and there's others out there who allow you to then have a back and forth conversation with that employee. I think without that, the employee doesn't really feel heard. It kind of feels like...
Probably does more harm than good though, right? If you're going to put something in a box and you don't get any reply, probably going to do the opposite, have the opposite effect.
Exactly. The
company doesn't care, et cetera. And they're going to feel, interesting.
Yeah. So with our platform, you get the initial feedback from the employee. Then you can correspond with them. You can ask them questions. You can provide them coaching or information or support. You can ask for more information if you need more information. You can tell them we're looking into this and give them updates along the way. And then our system actually sends the employee a follow-up survey just to say, hey, are you aware of your company taking any steps to address the issue that you raised? And how satisfied are you with the steps they took? And that goes back to the company.
So you're also holding them accountable.
Yes, exactly. So the company knows not only, okay, have we followed up with this person, but how did this person feel about the way that we handled this? And I think that's been missing historically as well.
Yeah, because you could, that's a great point, because otherwise you're completely missing that part. You can have a conversation about the issue, but did that person feel, because they're not going to do another complaint, but right. they're not going to put another message in there saying, this is my complaint, I didn't feel like you heard. They're probably not, right? They probably walk away dissatisfied and you don't know that.
Disengage
Absolutely. Again. So how does it work? Like, is it just like an app that people, like the employer would download, or web app, both? Like, typically, how does it work?
Yeah, it's a web app. So we did a bunch of research early on. We did tons of user testing because at the time this was kind of a novel concept. We hadn't seen anything like this. The closest we had seen was a whistleblower hotline, and we knew that was not something we should.
Is that literally a phone number? Is that literally someone calling when you say hotline, by the way?
It's a hotline, a phone number where you call, and
literally,
and you can imagine how intimidating
that would be. Terrifying. So when you said hotline, and by the way, just sort of a bit off topic. Oh, no, not really off topic. Do you think we need to rebrand that? I feel like that's a horrible thing. Like, whistleblower for me doesn't inspire confidence. I feel like that needs a rebrand.
Yes, that's what we tried to do. We purposely don't call ours a hotline. Sometimes the whistleblower hotlines have a web interface as well, but
we don't call it whistleblower, do you? What do you call yours? Like, do you call it whistleblower?
No, we just call it a reporting tool.
Yeah, just get rid of whistleblower. I feel like that's just like, I'm a whistleblower. He's like, you're not Edward Snowden, like,
Right, exactly. That's what we think of, and now he's,
in prison or on the run in Russia somewhere. Exactly. We should definitely rebrand that, because that's not helping things.
Scary.
All right, so it's a web app that people access.
So it's a web app. So we did a bunch of research. We found that people did not want to download an app, right? They felt that would be de-anonymizing. They did not want to create an account with an email and password, because your email is usually your name.
Yeah, makes sense.
Your work email is even more inextricably linked to your work identity, right?
Yeah.
So what we did was and my co-founder is Sean Rad, who's the co-founder of Tinder.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, really?
He has... Yeah.
So you've got some good experience there then of like the anonymous, go on, carry on. I'm interrupting you. Yeah.
He's an amazing product mind, and he has an ability. I mean, if you think about Tinder was like, we don't need a dating profile. Nobody's going
to. Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, exactly.
We're like essentialists, right? We want some pictures. We want like swipe left or right. Do you like this person or not? Because that's what people were really doing on dating apps anyway. They weren't making decisions based on, the text underneath.
It's quite sad though, when you think about it, right? It's just like, yes, no. Anyway, yeah.
But you have to be attracted, right? Or else like, what's the point?
Yeah, I get it. And clearly he was right, obviously. And that's a human nature, whether you like it or not. That's the first initial reaction.
Yeah, so he was very involved specifically in like the employee facing aspect of the product. What is the employee seeing? Is this essential? I think when I initially worked on the design, there was like 20 screens the employee had to get through just to submit a report. And he's like, no, take this out. So he's a big part of the reason why it's so incredibly simple. So they just, the company gives them a link. It's marketed internally throughout the company, this unique link that they can go to. They put in a little bit of information. It's not like a police report. It's not scary and overwhelming. We use like really calming colors and made it super simple and easy to do on your phone. A few clicks, a few, you know.
How long does it typically take? I know you've probably done, you're definitely a data person, so I know you got that.
Yeah, like a few minutes.
Literally a few minutes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the very end, they put in their phone number. We encrypt their phone number. We don't see it. The company doesn't see it. But when their company follows up with them, we send them a text that just says, hey, your company has responded to your report. Here's a link to view that. And it takes them to a little like messaging page where they can just see what the company said, you know, when they said it. They can look back at their initial report and remember exactly how they phrased things, and they can respond. So it's all like, it's not account-based, it's all mobile. And then on the company side, they have actually a really robust backend. So they have a dashboard, they have, you know, graphs and charts, and we flag trends for them, and they have the messaging piece. And so, you know, that part of it is a lot more complex because they're managing a bunch of different reports.
Yeah, they want to see the data and the trends, and they can identify. Yep. They want to be able to see things ahead of time before they escalate, perhaps to becoming an issue as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if we had done this 10 years ago, it probably would still be scary for someone to put their phone number in into an application. But I think because of like Postmates and all of these companies that, you know, ask for your phone number, Lyft and Uber, and you're texting with your driver, you understand the concept of
encryption.
I'm not actually texting with my driver.
Yeah, yeah. You're right. It would have been too much for people back then. They're like, wait a minute. But now I think people understand using all these apps that it's automatically encrypted end to end anyway.
Exactly.
As well. I love that because I did have concerns about it. I was thinking if you were going to sign up to, obviously you've done a lot of research behind it, but you want to make it simple, especially when someone's in that state of mind and there's obviously that worry and anxiety. You want to make it seamless and simple as possible, right down to, as you mentioned, even the color scheme, the calming choice of that, and just making people feel comfortable doing that as well. Because that's all you really need to get the conversation started. You don't need to ask for all this information. Yes, you would love it because the more information you have, et cetera. But at that point, you want to just get the conversation started, right? And understand.
Yes, and anything that's a barrier to that, you have to take it out. So like companies will say, hey, can you add, you know, demographic questions in? Mm-hmm. We understand why they would want that, but unfortunately that's not relevant to specifically hearing from employees and communicating back with them. So when we actually included that in some of our user testing, that was a huge sticking point for employees. They were like, I'm not putting in my gender, my age, my sexual
orientation. Because why should that matter?
Right. This is all about stripping all of that away. Because if you think about the very real biases that people face at work, you know, because of gender, because of age, because of any of these attributes, that's part of, you know, what they can't strip off as they go into a meeting with HR. So we're not going to add that back into our product.
Mm-hmm. You provide resources to the company as well to assist them?
Yes. So we provide tons of, like I said, we flag things for them that are, you know, becoming high level issues, and we allow them to kind of like filter and drill down.
How is that done? Is that through sentiment analysis? Like in terms of like identifying common things that people are saying, how does that work?
It's basically kind of an automated analysis of the structured data that we collect up front from the employee. So like, we'll ask like, what's your department and what's your
okay, location? So all right, so you can see based on sales, whoever's the big issues here, there's a lot going on in sales. Are you going to get to that point, or do you already do that, sort of looking at keywords within what they're saying and doing some sentiment analysis that way? Is that even valuable?
I think eventually it would be. We've sort of erred on the side of like staying out of their data, staying out of the employee's data, like anything that. You know, basically what you would have to do, because I did this at Thorne, is you could get basically training data for an algorithm that could show the algorithm like, okay, this is an example of a healthy culture and this is an example of an unhealthy culture. And, but we haven't done that yet because of kind of what it would entail to get that foundation in place. Mm-hmm. We'd have to use data. Now, I think there's an interesting opportunity there because we actually have a publicly available side of our tool. So the general public can also use our tool to share feedback. And that data is kind of different because we're passing along those reports to companies who are not signed up with us. We don't have a contract with them. We aren't guaranteeing all of the data privacy and security to them because we're not, you know, working with them. So that data is ours to analyze. So that might be a place where we could start to mm-hmm. do some investigation into like sentiment analysis and NLP and stuff like that.
Yeah. Cool. So I was asking really random questions. I was just excited about it.
It's a good question.
Seeing it as well. What's the initial reaction? When companies that you work with, do they do like a big launch internally? Like if they just start working with you and say, look, this is, you know, we've just partnered with All Voices and they promote that, do they typically see like an influx of inquiries immediately? I'm just wondering like if that happens, or are they sometimes like, maybe we slowly introduce this into the organization. I just wonder what the typical reaction is to companies that you partner with and how they go about, you know, you could have the best app in the world, but unless you communicate it and embed it in the organization and the culture, then it's not going to make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think unsurprisingly, the companies that talk the most about All Voices and market it the most and, you know, we'll come in actually and do like a lunch and learn, or we'll join a town hall and talk about the genesis of the idea and why we built it and kind of share with employees our reasoning for starting this company. I think that helps employees build a lot of trust in the system, that it's not a trick that their company's playing. It's not one of these, you know, the example I gave you earlier about the anonymous, quote unquote, anonymous culture survey. That we're a company who at our core started because we felt that employees needed a safer way to speak up at work. And they can hear that and see that when we are brought into the conversation.
That's really cool, by the way, that you come into mm-hmm. the conversation that way. So much more, like not saying they shouldn't trust their company, but it's so much cooler and authentic coming from you. You know, this is, mm-hmm. you literally quit your job, started this company, clear why, clear purpose. This is what we are. This is what we do. You know, you're safe in our hands and we're here for the right reasons.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's right. And then I think it's helpful to have that kind of those touch points like on an ongoing basis. So one example is we have an all hands question module. So companies, you know, when we were in person, it's one thing, and also virtually it's another, but having an all hands meeting and asking people to raise their hands and share a question, that can be a very intimidating or overwhelming experience for people. So there's some tools out there that, or even just like a Google form where you can ask a question anonymously. Sometimes they're trusted to be anonymous, sometimes not. We were like, how can we improve upon that process further? And we thought about, in particular, people who ask questions at an all hands meeting and their question, like they submit it electronically, they wait the whole meeting to hear the response. It's never addressed. That is the same example as I gave you earlier.
About as the box. Yeah.
Just feels unheard. They feel disengaged. So we added an all hands module so they can collect questions up front. They can answer the ones they want at the actual meeting. And then anyone they don't get to because they run out of time or it's not appropriate for that venue, they can actually respond directly to that person through the tool. So that's like, it's a valuable resource for them, for the companies and for the employees. It's also a good reminder if at every all hands they say, hey, thanks for submitting your questions through All Voices. As a reminder, this is what this tool is all about. So that's the kind of
thing. That's a cool way to keep it going. Like if you have, and most companies now, they've, even after people are starting to return to the office, most companies I spoke to have decided to continue those all hands that they were having during the pandemic. Like, why weren't we doing this before? We shouldn't be doing this once a year or once a quarter. So to have everything submitted via All Voices for the questions is a massive, I can imagine, be the great way to keep the momentum and people using the platform and understanding that, oh wow, that person, if I didn't do it, that person did, and now they're addressing it in the all hands. So it just, oh okay, they are listening. Maybe I should go in and actually put how I'm feeling in there and et cetera as well.
Yeah. And if you have a good experience with the all hands module, right? Like You asked a question, it got responded to either in the meeting or not. Nobody knew your identity. You know, you start to trust the platform further. And then if you do have an issue with something like bullying, you'll feel more comfortable using it in the future for that purpose.
Mm-hmm. I think I asked this before, but the resources. So do you provide resources and signposts? Because I'm sure some of the requests that companies are getting, they perhaps never even had to deal with before, or they have, but there may be different levels, you know, of the escalations. It may require, and many HR professionals may not have the experience to deal with that.
Yeah, that's a big focus of ours. So we provide a lot of like recommendations. So even from the outset, we'll provide a best practices guide. We'll provide like a templates for messaging. So here's some starting points for various types of issues. And you can obviously edit those to your liking, but this is a good starting point. Cause like you said, sometimes people are junior or just starting out in HR and may not feel quite comfortable with responding to those messages yet. It's very important to respond to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And then as they start to get data, they start to see, okay, you know, we're getting a lot of reports about bias in this department specifically. Maybe we need to have a training. We have all different kinds of partners that we can recommend for different types of services or training, like DEI coaches mm-hmm. or people who do unconscious bias training or sexual harassment training. So the idea is really to like pair them up with the right service providers who can help them with the issue that's being raised. And then one of the big focuses for us this year from a product perspective is to build some of that into the tool itself.
Almost like a marketplace.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like a help center, you know, a marketplace, some more sort of guidance, like step-by-step guidance through the tool for different types of issues and how to, beyond just the communication and the response, how to actually take action. So that's something we're really excited about for this year.
Yeah. Do you have companies, you mentioned some of the training elements that can come out of that, which this can help drive and uncover. Have you had companies request that you build like an API into some of their learning management tools? Just random. Has that been a request that people have asked?
Yes. Yeah. So there have been tons of requests for different types of integrations for us to provide certain things that we haven't, like actual content for employees or policy management. So there's a lot of different directions we can go.
Like one step at a time. We're just getting started. Yeah.
The most recent thing we did that we thought actually was really value add for our customers and for us was we layered a case management system on top of all of this. So as employees are coming forward directly to HR, HR and other administrators on the tool can input their own cases that they're trying to track and manage and collaborate on.
Didn't come through the app.
That did not come in.
So they can manage them all in one place, basically.
Yes. So okay. Like when they have turnover, that person's cases are that they're working on are all already in there. They can assign them to other people. They can visualize the data kind of alongside one another. So they can say, these are the things that are coming in through the tool. These are the things that are coming into us directly. How are they different? How are they the same?
Mm-hmm. And why are these ones coming through the tool and why are these not?
Exactly. And we do ask employees, why did you want to use All Voices to report this? So we have that data for the customer. And then we do an HRIS integration so that they can see an employee history.
That's what I meant earlier, by the way, when I was saying about the API. That was one of the things, I know I said LMS, but that was also one of the things I was thinking about. So you can see everything in one place. Yes. Because otherwise you're going to have to go to another login somewhere else to see that information as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody wants to do that. So let's say they get a report, you know, directly from a person who comes into their office. When they enter it into the system, they put that person's name. You can click the name and you can see everything that person has brought up so far. And, you know,
at what point do they see the name though? Only if they come in.
The person comes to them directly.
Oh, only if they come to them directly. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise they don't see a name at all.
What stage do they see the name? How does it get to the point if the person is comfortable, they need to have a conversation in person, for example, and resolve that? How does that work?
Well, it's really interesting. A lot of times you can actually drive resolution on an issue without ever knowing that person's identity. So the example I gave you earlier about bullying happening on Slack, you just need to go to the Slack channel, right? And see what's happening in that Slack. Let's say it's in like the sales Slack channel. And let's say like 2 to 3 people reported bullying happening in that channel. You can review that, what's happening in that channel, or ask the manager of the sales team to review what's happening. And you could actually go to the person who's bullying, and it doesn't need to be punitive at first. It can just be raising their awareness about the fact that people are feeling this way. And you don't have to say who's feeling that way to have that conversation.
Yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm.
So that person could know, hey, people are not responding well to the way that I'm talking in this channel. Now I have awareness of it, and I'm going to change my behavior. And that, if that changes, that's a resolved issue, right? Another example is, this was one of the first things we heard about from one of our customers, but one of our customers had a Halloween costume contest, and they had a person dress as a religious figure for the contest and won the contest. And then jokes were being made about it after the fact on Slack. And there was a person of that religion at the company who submitted an all voices report and just said, hey, I don't mean to be difficult, but like, that's my religion. And it made me really uncomfortable. I feel very like excluded here. They saw that message. They responded to that person. They said, you know, we're so sorry about this, and we're going to take action to change our costume contest policy so that religious figures are not an acceptable, you know, costume in the future. And I think in their case, they told me that they even notified that person who had dressed up and just said, like, this was offensive to someone. Would you mind just sending an apology to the, you know, on Slack, just that, you know, you didn't know. And this person was not getting in trouble. Again,
yeah, they're probably, you'd hope that they're the vast majority of the cases, right? And I'm sure, is that the case, given the data that you're looking at, that they can be resolved outside of, you know?
Yeah, I think a ton can be. I think even more than companies think when they start using all voices.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times it's about what and where and when, but not necessarily who brought it forward.
Yeah, they probably prefer that as well. The person who brought it forward, they remain anonymous throughout the whole process, and it becomes, and it gets resolved. I would prefer that. I can only imagine if it's been resolved, and I don't even have to have a conversation with someone or have that awkward, you know, that's the part that will become very intimidating and awkward, having to face or just speak to someone face to face would be really tough.
I mean, in that case also, if you think about it from the company's perspective, it doesn't really matter who's offended specifically or who was upset by it. It just matters that someone was, and they didn't know, and then they found out. And I think they handled it really responsibly, which is just, you know, to kind of like close the loop with that person and say, mm-hmm. Hey, here are all the things we did, and thank you for bringing this to our attention.
Yeah. Cool. What's I'd love to hear your experience as well. What's your experience being as a female sort of tech founder, especially in this space as well? What's your experience been?
Just in general, what's
like tech founder. Like I speak to people in this space all the time, and there's not many female tech founders in this space as well. So I just wanted to understand, hear your experience being in this space.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know anything different, right? This is my only experience, right? Is being a woman and being a founder.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, when I, and maybe it's because of the topic that I work on, but when I was doing this research on, you know, during as Me Too was kind of simmering over the summer of 2017, I heard a lot of things about like inappropriate, you know, investor founder relationships or like investors making comments that were, you know, sexualizing in nature to female founders and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I personally haven't experienced that. I think because I'm going in talking about what I'm talking
That's
about.
That's probably gonna, yeah.
Yeah.
If that doesn't do it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You really don't wanna make sexual advances against someone who's like dedicating their career to this topic. So So I haven't had those types of experiences. I will say, like, I think there is just inherent bias against female founders. I've heard about it, I've seen it, I'm sure I've experienced it. I have no way of knowing for sure, right? I can't repeat the experiment as a man fundraising, but I just know it's there because there are studies and there's research, and there's a really interesting study about how the questions that investors ask are different to
Interesting.
women versus men. Yes.
Okay.
So they
Do you
ask
have an
men,
example? Do you have, oh, you got one. Okay, go for it.
they ask women questions about more focused on like protecting against risks, right? Like, how are you going to defend, you know, do you have a moat? Like, how are you going to defend against another competitor? And they ask men questions that give them the opportunity to kind of like forecast into the future about how big something can get and how, you know what I mean?
The
Like, how big could
opposite.
this market be,
It's like
right?
a,
It's the opposite.
yeah, he literally the complete opposite.
Yeah. And this was published, I forget by whom, but you know, this, you can Google it. It's out there. And it's a known fact. And I've definitely, like I said, I can't run the experiment myself, but I definitely get a lot of questions about risks and challenges and competitors. And the article that I read about this study basically said, unfortunately, because this is just these like built-in biases, there's not much you can do other than as the founder, flipping the questions and answering the question that you want to answer. So that's what I try to do when fundraising, and that's something, you know, probably male founders who are raising money don't have to think about as much. Another thing that I read recently was DocSend, I believe, did a report on how the fundraising experience differs for men, all male founding teams versus all women founding teams. And how much time, because they track how much time investors spend looking at different pages of the deck. Like, that's,
Oh, they can see that, of
you know.
course. Yeah. Okay. How they can
So,
see what they've clicked, how long they've spent time. Hey, they've got all of
yep.
that.
So it reflected some of those same learnings from that other study, which is like, with men, they're much more focused on like the opportunity. With women, they're much more focused on the risks of the investment. And then they were tracking cohorts through, you know, pre-seed, seed, series A. They actually, in the cohort they started tracking at pre-seed, none of those women were able to raise a series A. So they had no point of comparison for female founding teams raising a series A. And obviously women raise their series A's, but that was just kind of illuminating to me, because it's like, it just shows there are larger barriers in place for women related to fundraising than men. So that's something I'm very aware of and you know, working against. And luckily, our company has been super successful. Like, we're doing great. We have great metrics. We don't need to even fundraise our Series A anytime soon. We have almost 2 years of runway, even at the burn that we're at now. But yeah, I think I'd be interested in fundraising soon, kind of opportunistically, just because of how well we're doing.
Yeah, makes
And I
sense.
have to really keep in
Keep that
mind
in
that
mind. But given
it's
what you
different.
do, though, that's the thing. But
Yep.
you, like you said, given what you do, you may not be seeing the full picture because, by inherently, what you're bringing to the table is discussing somebody's issue. So you may not be
Yeah.
seeing that entire. Because I've even had female founders that are friends of mine that have had questions about, like, what did you want to say recently? Oh, are you planning on having a family? Like,
Oh.
literally asking about kids. And like, because they may be their mid-30s, for example. And
Yep.
if you're going to start this company and we're going to invest, and that was a friend of mine recently that said, I was like, wow, I guarantee they're not asking men. Like,
No.
are you like, yeah, do you plan on having kids? As an example. And I was really, do you know what's bad? I wasn't, I was, it was shocking to hear, but I didn't, it wasn't unexpected, which is really bad. Like she told me, and I was like, I can imagine them saying that, which is really horrible to think about. But I wasn't as shocked as I should have been hearing that. I was like, oh my God, I can imagine being in a room, just being like, really?
Yeah.
That's the question you're asking right now?
And that goes all the way through. I mean, like Jeff Bezos, probably the most famous business person in the world. Do you even know anything about his kids? Do you know how old they are? Do you know their names, their genders, no, anything? No. Nothing. It's just not.
It's a non-issue.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. The media plays a role too, which is like by focusing on, you know, the like having a child aspect of mm-hmm. having families and not really focusing. We don't hear about Bill Gates's kids. We don't hear about Jeff Bezos' kids. It just creates a really unequal playing field.
Yeah. Or even like, not to that extent, but even like female leaders that I work with and speak to every day, you know, there have been multiple times where their boss has been said, oh, I didn't tell you about that promotion because, you know, I didn't think it would be of an interest because, you know, you have two kids. Mm-hmm. Like they were doing them a favor. Right. Whereas it's massively insulting as well. It's like, no, that's the unconscious bias there coming in some cases. You thinking you're doing them a favor by saying, by not giving up these opportunities, whereas actually it's the opposite as well. So we still have that existing. Very common.
There's so much more work to do, I think.
Yeah. So with the companies that you speak with, what's typically their biggest objection or sort of that you have to overcome for them to work with you? Because no one's going to say what you're doing isn't important. No one's going to come to you with that objection, right? But when it comes to actually signing on a dotted line and committing and not just talking the talk, but now you're walking the walk, what is typically the main thing that the hurdle to overcome?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny. I would say this a lot at first. We would not get a no at first from anybody. So
because
like,
who wants to say no to that? It's hard. Yeah. No. It's hard. So that's what I mean. That's what I mean. It must be. But yeah.
They would never say no. They would just quietly ghost us.
Ghost you. Yeah, I can imagine.
You know what I mean? Like no one wants to say, I don't need this or I don't want this. Now what's different? So this was a few years ago when we didn't really have any competitors in the space. We didn't have anybody doing what we're doing. Now I would say there's a few like startups that have popped up in this space, which I think is great, honestly, because this is a huge market and there needs to be more than one player in it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll come back and say, we chose to go with this other competitor just because of pricing. We increased our pricing as we added case management in and as we added all these new features in. And we have different pricing tiers and we try to really be able to accommodate, you know, nonprofits and schools and companies of different sizes. And, but sometimes, you know, someone will say, we really liked your product the most, but it's also the most expensive. So we went in a different direction. So we've been experimenting a bit with that. We don't want to lose customers simply because of price. I'd rather bring them in at a discount and have them see the value.
What themselves. Is it like a SaaS model? Like how does it work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an annual fee, and there's different tiers based on which of the features that you want.
Okay.
And also slightly different pricing just based on what size you are, like a company.
Yeah, that makes sense. You want to help, nonprofit, like you said, or you want to help people in as well. So that makes sense. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me. Honestly, like we only spoken twice, it's the second time, but I can tell that you're really living your purpose and your why and having a real impact. And I'm super happy for you and the work that you're doing as well. So keep up the amazing work as well. Hopefully this reaches as many people on our platform and they can reach out and work with you as well. Cause I think what you're doing is definitely worthwhile and so many companies and people can benefit from it. As well. Where can people connect with you? If they want to learn more, reach out to you, connect, where's the best place for them to go?
So you can reach out to me directly. My email is Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E at allvoices.co. Or you can go to our website and find out way more about the platform and you can read our blog. You can watch our webinars. You can look at all of our content because we try to provide a lot of like valuable content to our audience as well. And that's just that allvoices.co.
Amazing. Well, look, thanks again. Enjoy the rest of your day and I'll see you soon.
Thanks for having me. So nice to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks.